the discussion of the condition in which, in this marital relationship, one of the spouses is actually so much dependent on their family. They still are not feeling like mature enough to do the decision making, and they're just like these fledgling birds who depend on their parents for anything, for decision making, for even choosing the color of the shirt they're going to buy, anything. So in these conditions, how you as a lady have to react?
Before any reaction, we always have to take a pause and we have to understand the situation. So this phenomenon is termed as enmeshment in psychology, wherein it's a situation where the boundaries between the adult child and their parents are diffused that prevent the development of a fully autonomous identity. Like, you grow up and you are now married, but you still have not kind of grown up. You still are dependent exactly. on them so much for a lot of things, especially in decision making. So from a developmental psychology standpoint, this represents an incomplete transition to adulthood. The individual may struggle with anxiety when they are making decisions on their own. I actually have been there personally, like not me, but I have, like my husband has been excessively dependent on others. I would say not definitely parents, but maybe his friends for a huge decision making. So I know, like, because I realized when they are trying to make their own decisions, they feel huge anxiety. And that's because of a lot of reasons.
So why they don't trust their own spouses in decision making? Like, okay, you're dependent. Why not now projecting that dependence on this new partner in your life?
Well, it's not about that they are not trusting. It's because that their primary reference point for validation has always been someone else, like since their childhood. And maybe sometimes it always remains their parents. And in many cultures, like in ours, I would say, it has been seen as a virtue than a problem.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like I come from India, and in those cultures, if you are discussing things with directly with spouses and you're not taking parents into the decision making, then it's seen as like something like you have done some moral vice.
Yeah.
So including parents in each and every decision, or like big decisions especially, it's seen as virtue. And this is not necessarily seen as a problem in these cultures. And it's considered as respect for elders and maintaining family harmony. True, that's true. But it should not be like for every minor decision, everything.
Mm-hmm.
There could be many other causes. Like in my case, like as I told you, like my husband would rely on his friends for major decisions. Like, for example, once we had to buy something for someone else. Like my uncle was living in another country and I was here, and he wanted to gift his wife something, and he wanted us to buy, say for example, gold from here, right? So buying gold was a kind of big decision for my husband, and he was asking each and every friend, like, which show, where, how, when. I know, like, some suggestions, some consultations are important, some are okay. But then, like, he took
excessively being dependent on them is just an obsession.
He took almost 2 months for this decision. So I was like, yeah, and I told him, like, 2 months ago we would have got this thing for this much, and after 2 months we will get this for this much. So like, this in itself is a huge mistake. And then he said to me, like, we spoke to each other, and he said, I am afraid of shopping alone. So it's been a problem always because I have not faced it directly. So that's why I'm always dependent on others for these huge decisions.
Yeah, so as we can see, it's really sometimes it turns into a problem, an obsession. Like, you have to sit and talk about it, because in some severe points, it gets into the major cause of maybe a turmoil in the family, in a house which has been newly just established for two lovers, like coming in the hope of finding love, and then suddenly encountering someone who is in their childhood. So this is an actual problem, and we have to face the realities of these issues. and dig deeper into the major cause of them. But before that, we go for the break and then we come back. So stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
To be mature is something, and to grow older is another thing. Sometimes you only grow older as in the number of your age, but the maturity does not happen. Yes, you're listening to Muslim Lady. I'm Asma, and Sister Zainab is with us, and we're just talking about the fact that in many cases, in many cases of marriage, there is this condition in which one of the spouses is relying too excessively on their parents or a third person in decision making, which is a problem in itself. So you said that there are some psychological causes, some psychological justifications for that. But are there any ways out?
Of course there are ways out. But before we go to the way out, we will try to understand some other causes as well. Like, for example, there could be also sometimes financial dependence. For example, if parents are providing enough financial support, example, for a home or for a car, for a living expense. And it often, comes with strings attached explicitly or implicitly. The parents feel that they have the right to be involved in your decisions because they are supporting you. So, which again is not true. So another could be emotional dependence, which is a huge, one of the biggest causes. Because they may have a history of relying on parents for emotional regulation and problem solving. So another thing is emotional dependence. They may have a history of relying on parents for emotional regulation and problem solving. And this also creates a pattern where in times of stress, they default to their parents instead of turning to their spouse. Like, it really takes them a hard time to understand that now they're in a new life. And they should be having these problem-solving skills. We all, as children, we turn to our parents for problem-solving issues. But then there are some good schools as well that teach you. Or sometimes these things are not taught in the school, but life teaches you.
Exactly.
So by time of your marriage, you should really have learned the skills of problem-solving and decision-making yourself. That's why in Islamic tarbiyah as well, we have three stages, as per Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family. He said that do tarbiyah in three stages, three sevens. Like, the first 7 years, treat them as kings and queens. In the second 7 years, treat them as your servants. Like, not servants in literal terms, but give them responsibilities.
Yeah, give them tasks.
Give them tasks. Yeah, so like let them do the things now because they were in the kingship phase until now. Now let them. Some people do not come out of this being a king or a queen until they are married even. Yeah. So that's why
they remain as kings and queens forever.
Yeah, and then they create problems in their marital life.
Exactly.
And the third phase, which is very, very important, I guess, the last seventh phase, which is from 14 onwards to 21, it says that treat them as your advisors, take them as your advisors in decision making.
Yeah.
So you're involving them basically. See, in Islamic lifestyle, we involve children in decision making. Mm-hmm. So we are teaching them the problem solving skills and other skills, decision making.
By the way, this just reminds me of another issue. I guess parents are themselves part of the ones to be blamed. Like, in some occasions, I've seen many parents who make their children dependent on them. Like, they don't give them this freedom to, okay, this is your problem, you have to face it, you're an adult and right now you have to face it, you have to find the solution by yourself. We're here to support, but that doesn't mean we're going to be the solvers. Like, we're not the problem solvers. The case that we were talking about was the case of those people who rely deeply and excessively and obsessively on their parents for decision making, and they have a trustee and they rely on that trustee forever in all the decision making. But this is not what adults must do. They have to be mature enough to take responsibility and to shoulder the burden of their decision making.
Yeah. So, you know, when you are excluding another person, like the one who is living with you in the decision making, they feel devalued and they feel untrusted and they feel like an outsider in their own marriage. It creates a two against one dynamic where the one who was amnished spouse and their parents, they form a coalition against the one who is like kind of disempowered now. So they fail to develop their own unique identity, conflict resolution skills. Like even if there are sometimes, you know, we have a lot of these cases, like there's a conflict between husband and wife, and then you inform your parents, like the girl, not always husband, a girl informs her parents, and then she keeps listening to her mother or all the decisions from outside without giving the time that it can solve it themselves, which creates in itself a huge problems. So what could be done? Yes, do integrate your parents in your decisions, but do not eliminate your spouse. The goal is not to dismiss the parental opinion outright. It is to create a process like the couple discusses an issue first. Once they have united front together and a clear understanding on each other's views, they can now choose or seek counsel from parents. And then there's also, like, you should create boundaries, like healthy boundaries with parents are permeable. It's not like something you're doing something against Islam.
Yeah. Perfect fences make perfect neighbors.
Yeah, so like autonomy of, it creates autonomy of marital unit. So it's not like you're doing something anti-Islamic. So couples must decide together what topics are open for discussion with parents, like general life updates. But some things are there which are strictly private, and I suggest that they should be discussed with each other. So yeah, this way you're actually giving the other person a personality and valuing them and valuing their intellectual power, respecting them, seeing their strengths and their weaknesses and their perspectives.
So simply, if we want to just give the gist of what you said as the ways out, is that first of all, recognize it. Second of all, try to work on it. Do not exclude your spouse. Give them their value and let them feel worthy of notice. Let them feel that they have been seen. They are recognizable and they have a great share in decision making.
Because, you know, Quran also says that consult with each other. It says twice that consult together courteously. It's Surah Talaq, verse number 6. And also in Surah Baqarah, verse 233, we have, if both sides decide after mutual consultation and consent, then so and so on. So like, you know, mutual consent, both sides deciding, it gives importance.
And sharing ideas, interacting, yeah. Having this
it tells
interaction
the whole
for
story
ideas,
like how important your opinions are, not just one side. But
yeah,
both sides.
But unfortunately, we're running out of time and we cannot talk more about this topic. So, dear ladies, I hope you've enjoyed today's episode and I hope that all these insights might come to your help one way or another. But this is all for today. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Good night to all listeners of Iran Radio. This is Tehran, the Iranian capital, and I'm Asma, your presenter for the next hour. We'll start this hour's lineup with our varied radio productions feature. That will be followed by Insight into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis or explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. And we round up this hour's programs with Islamic laws. The program focuses on Islamic laws and adopts a practical approach to the subject. Stay with us for the next hour.
Palestinians are terrorists because they use human shields, right? Well, that's what the Zionists love to say when they justify bombing hospitals and schools. They routinely claim that Hamas houses command and control centers underneath hospitals, apartment buildings, and schools. Of course, all of that has been debunked and is a total lie. But what if I told you that the Israelis were projecting? Because we all know that their every accusation is a confession. Well, a groundbreaking report by the Gray Zone has just exposed a highly secretive IDF command and control center beneath a densely populated civilian area in North Tel Aviv. And the best part, Iran directly bombed it during the 12-day war with Israel back in June. On June 13th, Iran launched a barrage of missiles at Israel. The Zionists immediately began crying about how Iran was bombing civilians, not caring about the fact that they had been slaughtering civilians themselves in hospitals and schools in Gaza for 2 years. But as it turns out, Iran wasn't firing inaccurate missiles indiscriminately at Israeli civilians. They were actually targeting high-value military targets. In this clip here, you can see the Fox journalist Trey Yanks reporting the aftermath of the targeted site. He was immediately told to stop filming by Israeli police.
The Iranians have responded with three waves of ballistic missiles. This is Israel's version of the Pentagon, the Kiryat. And the building on this compound was just hit.
Please go back. Go back, please.
You can understand here, it's very tense at this location. Because the Iranians are now targeting the defense establishment of Israel. And so I'm going to have my cameraman pan up here to this building just across the street from the
Kiryat.
And so...
Moments prior, Iran had struck the north tower of the Da Vinci apartment complex roughly 550 meters southwest of Yink's location. The Gray Zone determined that the building sits immediately south of the Kanaret Israeli Air Force towers and above an underground military intelligence bunker jointly administered by the U.S. and Israeli militaries. According to an analysis of leaked emails, public documents, and Israeli news reports, the location is host to a highly secretive, electromagnetically shielded intelligence facility known as Site 81. Leaked emails from a former Israeli military chief of staff further indicate that Site 81 is an important command and control node. The Jerusalem Post also reported that an Iranian missile that struck the Da Vinci Towers was just a stone's throw from Netanyahu's office, which was then known as Building 22. The Prime Minister's office began undergoing renovations just weeks after the 2025 12-day war between Israel and Iran, and is rumored to have been damaged in the strike. Now, unfortunately, you can't use Google Maps to view the area because they have censored and blurred the information in order to protect its secrecy. A photo photo of Site 81 published by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in February 2013 as part of a corrosion test of the underground structure's concrete overlay in galvanized steel plating can be geolocated to what is now the site of the Da Vinci apartment towers, with the southern of the two 18-story Israeli Air Force Knesset towers just meters away. According to a website for the Knesset towers, published by the Israeli construction firm Dan Yakibis, the buildings were constructed for the Israeli Air Force headquarters. The Israeli aluminum building enclosure company Elu Meshet described its work on the towers in 2002 as including the construction of a blast mitigation system ensuring maximum security. But despite the sophisticated engineering, secrecy, and protection, Iran was still able to strike it and damage it. One Israeli resident of the tower complained that he was being used as a human shield. Quote, "Today I realize I've been paying 12,000 shekels or $3,650 a month to protect the Kiria," the resident explained, using the common shorthand for the Israeli military headquarters. The geolocation of the Site 81 photo suggests that the Da Vinci Towers are also protecting the secretive underground intelligence facility. The bunker is apparently located less than 100 meters from a children's playground, alongside a large community center which opened at the base of the towers in July 2023. By situating some of its most sensitive military installations in the heart of a civilian area, Israel has engaged in the human shielding practice it routinely accuses Palestinians of exploiting. A previously unreported leaked email exchange between ex-NATO commander James Stavridis and former Israeli military chief of staff Gabi Ashkenazi appears to confirm the presence of a command and control network operating inside the Site 81 bunker, smack in the middle of a densely populated civilian area. "Hi Gabi," Stavridis wrote to Ashkenazi on September 1st, 2015. "I am working with an exciting company called Think Logical here in the USA. They build command and control networks and just won a big contract out at Site 81 with the IDF." Not only does this further expose Israel as the hypocritical genocidal state that it is, it also validates Iran's claims of having significantly damaged Israeli military infrastructure. Throughout the 12-day war, Israel bombed Iranian civilians, murdering hundreds of innocent people, including babies, while complaining about Iran supposedly indiscriminately bombing their civilians. Zionist propagandists also boasted about taking out Iran's more sophisticated missiles in their surprise attack, forcing them to rely on older, less accurate missiles incapable of precisely hitting their targets.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 33rd verse of Surah Al-Ankabut. So, let's listen to the verse, and we will be back with our discussion.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ولما أن جاءت رسلنا لوطا سيء بهم وضاق بهم ذرعا وقالوا لا تخف ولا تحزن إِنَّا مُنَجُّوكَ وَأَهْلَكَ إِلَّا امْرَأَتَكَ كَانَتْ مِنَ الْغَابِرِينَ.
And when our messengers came to Lot, he was distressed for them and felt for them great discomfort. They said, "Fear not, nor grieve. Indeed, we will save you and your family, except your wife. She is to be of those who remain behind."
So, up to now, as you were with us throughout the previous verses, we explained the story of Prophet Lut, how he was worried about his people and their indecency and their lewdness. He tried to invite them to monotheism, and he tried to actually make them leave this kind of indecency, but they didn't. The Almighty Allah actually sent his messenger angels to Prophet Abraham. They brought him glad tidings first, but then they said that inna muhliku ahli hadhihi alqarya, we are to destroy these people, the people of this town. So when these angels went to Prophet Lut to introduce themselves, to tell him what is going to happen to his people, he was worried. Why? Because he was even worried about the fact that those people of his are going to even attack these actually guests, even though they did not know them. And that's how the situation actually was, because the location of the people of Lut was actually in between the different paths that some caravans were passing by, so they had to stay there. But after some times, those caravans understood what is going on. They tried to step away from them. They tried to find alternative paths and ways to reach their destinations. But anyway, Lut's anxiety, as the verse says, "See abihim wa dhaqa bihim dhara," he grieved on their account, he distressed for them, was not for the fact that he did not know them. No, that was not the point. He, because in their, they were in the form of some handsome youths, the arrival of such guests would actually mean that there will be some trouble for them. And they will be probably disrespected if the people of Lut were to understand. And in some narrations we have heard that it was the wife of this prophet who informed the people of the town that there were some new guests in the house of their prophet. So that's why we should not actually be astonished when the verse says, وَلَا تَحْزَنْ إِنَّا مُنَجُّوكَ وَأَهْلَكَ إِلَّا امْرَأَتَكَ, we will surely deliver your family and we will surely deliver you, of course, munajuka wa ahlaka illa imra'atak, except your wife, kanat min al-ghabirin. She shall be of those who stay behind. So, of course, that's how the situation was. So, the messengers of Almighty Allah introduced themselves to Lut, and by means of divine miracle, they made the eyes of those attacking people blind, and they caused the heart of this great prophet to rest. So that's how the situation was. The people tried to attack and disgrace actually these new guests. But that's how the power of the Almighty Allah becomes effective. It is notable that the messenger angels of Allah told Lut ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam that he should not fear and grieve. La takhaf wa la tahzan. That's what they told him. Concerning the difference between la takhaf wa la tahzan, it is cited in the Al-Mizan, the commentary, that khawf is used about the inconvenient probable events, but huzn is about some decisive and certain instances. So, some commentators believe that the Quranic word khawf relates to the future events, and the term actually huzn and gham relates to the past events. It is, of course, probable that khawf is used in relation to dangerous instances, but huzn and gham is related to painful events. So, anyway, there is a question here that, according to the verses of Surah Hud, the fear and grief of Lut were not about himself, but he feared that those evil people might make trouble for his guests. While the answer the angels gave him was about the deliverance of Lut and his family, and these two are not consistent with each other. But the answer to this question can be understood from Surah Hud, because when these shameful people came to bother the guests, the angels told Lut, لا تخف ولا تحزن إنا منجوك وأهلك. Do not fear, do not grieve, verily we shall deliver you and your family. So, that is, they not only cannot bother us, that's what they meant, but also are not going to be able to hurt you. Therefore, the angels took their deliverance certain, and verily it was certain, and they concentrated the glad tidings on the deliverance of Lut and his family. So that's how the situation turned out, and we will continue the rest of the verses and their discussion in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Greetings to you and very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on. I am at your service.
Thank you very much for accepting offer to come to the studio and shed some light on the jurisprudential laws or Islamic laws according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And we are actually dealing with some of these jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me begin our episode with this question. What are the laws for aqiqah, right? And more specifically, I want to ask you if the meat is eaten by the parents of the very child that they have sacrificed, for example, or they have given out an aqiqah, is it okay for them to eat a part of that, for example, aqiqah, or not?
Right. Well, aqiqah is a sacrifice, okay, that is recommended to be carried out on the seventh day of the child's birth, whether a boy or a son. And there are certain conditions which are not mandatory, because the aqiqah itself is not mandatory. When something is not mandatory, the rules and the restrictions surrounding that
are more flexible,
and they are not mandatory either. They are not obligatory.
What about the kind of sacrifice after 1 year, like the birth of a child?
Okay.
Is it still called an aqiqah, or only it should be actually the, we are calling the sacrifice after the seventh day of the birthday of a child?
Well, it is still called aqiqah. If he has not given, if he has not sacrificed an animal on the seventh day, so it can be done at any time or
in the future. Right.
Whether you are, let's say, 1 year old, or when you are 20 years old or 30 years old.
Yes.
Aqiqah will have its impact, or it is sawab for the person who sacrifices an animal and distributes the meat.
Yes.
The thing is that you said that whether it's allowed for the parents to receive a portion of the meat and eat or consume it, of course it is discouraged. It is not haram, but it's better for the parents not to eat, for the grandparents also, not to eat the meat of the animal slaughtered by them with the intention of aqiqah, to bless the child.
Right.
Yes.
And what about the kind of animal that they can sacrifice? Is there any rule for that? Like whether it's a chicken or a a sheep?
It is not a chicken that should be slaughtered, okay? It's a lamb, okay, that's healthy. For example, if there is, let's say, a lamb which is 2 years old, and it has horns, okay?
Right.
Horns. The horns should not be broken.
Oh.
The lamb itself should be healthy. If one of its legs is broken and the horn is broken, it's discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It should be a perfect, healthy animal that you slaughter.
Only a lamb is referred to as the aqiqah.
It can be a cow, it can be a camel.
Yeah.
Okay, but people generally afford the lamb to sacrifice it.
But it's not certainly a chicken.
Yeah, it's not a chicken, of course.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, We know that sometimes when people get married, actually there is a period, like a gap in between their engagement and their marriage, right?
Right.
And my question is related to that gap, basically, between the engagement and the marriage. We know that the consent or agreement of the husband is necessary for the wife, usually during in the course of their lifetime.
Right.
But what happens to that small period or gap that we call the engagement period? They are engaged, the couple is engaged, but they are not married yet. So they are not married yet, they are engaged.
Do you mean that the marriage contract has not been solemnized?
Well, I mean, like, they have been engaged by giving out, for example, giving each other a ring. And they are officially registered as being engaged.
Okay.
Right? So whether it is the registrar office or somewhere else, or, for example, a religious scholar has pronounced the engagement formula for them, so sort of like marriage formula.
Well, to be honest, there's no such thing as engagement without, you know, without marriage contract. When a man is engaged,
yes,
people often understand that, okay, there's no nikah between them, and they are still no mahram to each other. They are unrelated to each other.
Yes.
Engagement doesn't mean that they can sit together, laugh, and start joking, touching each other. No, because there's no nikah. If there's no nikah, then they are still non-mahram to each other, and they should stay away from each other. They should not treat each other in the same way as couples or husbands and wives do that, treat each other. So they are non-mahram. But if a marriage formula has been recited, and the marriage has been solemnized, even though consummation of the marriage has not taken place,
right,
they are mahram to each other. So all boundaries or limits are removed when the nikah is conducted. Doesn't it depend on
whether they are living together or not? Cohabiting?
That's I want to talk about mahramiyya, okay, which is established by nikah.
Right.
But when it comes to permission of, let's say, going out, doing certain things, of course, as long as the husband does not provide his wife with food, clothing, and other regular expenses, and it's the father indeed, so the husband does not have the right to forbid his wife from going out of her father's house, because he does not provide his wife with food, clothing, other expenses. Okay, she is still in her father's house.
Right.
So it is her father who should allow him or allow her or permit her to go out or not to go out.
I see.
Yes. The husband, in that case, has no authority.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law regarding
the kind of prayer people are offering while they are doing so, or while they are saying their prayer, there is the sound of music in the surrounding.
Well, it is basically, it's not good to offer prayers in such places where music is being played and where one gets easily distracted. Okay, so what is not good is distraction, which
right.
takes place when one listens, when one hears music.
Right.
You, the person, the duty-bound person who prays,
mm-hmm.
does not listen to music intentionally.
Yes.
But it's something that, okay, comes to his ear and he hears the sound of the music. He's not to blame. But if there's no other place to offer his prayer, it's okay to pray in that very place. For example, someone goes to a wedding hall, and the wedding hall has a special place dedicated for people who want to pray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the same is the case with some airports. There are, for example, there is a special room for people who wants to pray.
Yes.
And of course, music is being played at the airport or at railway station or maybe wedding hall. And people cannot go out of the wedding hall or other places. And even if they go out, they don't find a place to offer their prayers.
Mm-hmm.
So music is there. So it's still permissible to offer one's prayer in that room or in that place.
Oh, okay. What about the situation where there is a non-mahram, somebody who's not related to you by marriage, actually?
Yes.
Is this kind of prayer that we are offering still valid? I mean, I'm talking about, for example, the women who are offering the prayer, but there is a non-mahram around in that very room, for example.
Of course, it is permissible. There's nothing wrong with that. When there's no other room for a lady, for a woman to offer her prayers, she is allowed to offer her prayers in that room or place where there is a non-mahram.
Right.
Okay. We do see a lot of ladies, especially those going to Atabat, to the holy sites in Najaf, Karbala, and Mashhad. They offer their prayers in the presence of lots of non-mahram people, okay?
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I see. And what about the kind of hijab or covering that women should wear while offering their prayer? Should they go in full hijab, right? Let me define the hijab that I'm talking about. Like, for example, is chador the kind of piece of cloth that Muslim women usually wear, like covering from head to toe? Is that necessary or no? Just the kind of covering that those parts which are obligatory to be covered, enough?
Well, a particular type of hijab or clothing is not recommended by Islam. Okay, Islam, for example, does not tell you what kind of hijab or what kind of dress you should wear. Okay. It depends on common sense and common understanding.
Right.
Okay, chador, in my opinion, is a perfect hijab. Okay.
Mm. Right.
But what is necessary according to Islam is to cover for a woman. What is necessary is to cover her hair, neck, and then legs, and also feet if there are non-mahram people around the woman.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not necessary to cover the feet when there's no non-mahram, and of course. It's not necessary to cover the face. It's not necessary to cover the hands up to the wrists.
Yes.
But other parts of the body must be covered.
Right.
Irrespective of whether there is any non-mahram around you, around a woman or not. Even if there's no one around the woman, she must still cover all parts of her body except the face and the hands up to the wrist.
And the color is not important.
The color is not important.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. That was Sheikh Javed, my guest speaker, talking with me in the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, where we talked about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. From me, Muhammad Javed, the host of this program, will be you very well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو الغفار الجميل الوهاب.
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You're tuned in to Iran Radio, coming to you from Tehran, and I'm Asma, your host for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a radio productions feature. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. After that, we have Around the World with reporters. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and far. Our varied radio productions feature will be next. And our final program this hour is A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Stay with us for the next hour.
News related to the Group of Seven is always controversial. At the annual meetings of the seven industrial nations, important issues are discussed. Topics such as political decisions, economic problems, and climate challenges.